Hey guys, before we get started, two things to warn you about. One, this show is full of spoilers about Star Wars. So take that for what it's worth and get out of here if you don't want to hear any. Second thing is, today's episode is brought to you by the Current Geek Box over at frogpants.cratejoy.com. What's inside this thing? Many cool things. But I can tell you one thing, the very first one shipping with a six-month calendar. It'll be a full calendar eventually, but the first half is in this box. And it is all printed artwork from me, and Tom has created a 2044 calendar in the year 2044. And I illustrate a whole bunch of it on each month. And it's awesome. I think you guys will really like it. That's just one of the many things that will be in your box. That's the Current Geek Monthly Box at frogpants.cratejoy.com. That's how we want to fuel this show. That's how you can support us. And that's how you can get some great swag. Again, frogpants.cratejoy.com.
I have
Current Geek!
Current Geek!
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Current Geek. This is Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars, Geeks of the World, and you, to talk about all the things that matter most in Star Wars Episode 7. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt.
That's a good point, Scott Johnson. If you don't want to be spoiled on Star Wars The Force Awakens, you need to stop listening to this podcast right now. Pull your vehicle carefully over to the side of the road, press pause, yank out the audio cable, whatever you need to do, because we are going to do nothing but spoil for the next hour.
Yeah, there's no rules. Zero things we can hold back on. That includes speculation about what we think may be coming, or speculation about what happened and why. We'll talk about everything to do with...
I even brought the Star Wars Visual Dictionary for ancillary material.
Oh, good. Well, ancillary material wouldn't be on the show. He turned me down. So instead, I brought three fantastic guests. Let's start with the man, the myth, the legend, Justin Robert Young. Justin, welcome to the show.
It's a show filled with spoilers. It's almost as if it's a spoiler show.
Whoa. Hey, are we killing two birds with one stone right now? Is that what this is going to do to us?
I feel like it might.
All right.
I feel like this might also be the spoiler show with Scott and Justin.
Do you guys want to do your intro within Current Geek?
Oh, my gosh. No, because somewhere there's a guy from Middle Eastern descent driving a van really slowly into a river, and I'm not comfortable with all of these Inception ideas, so forget it.
Well, I mean, you can just play the one organ sounder that normally opens the show.
Yeah, we can do that. All right. Well, Justin, it's good to have you here. I can't wait to hear your take.
Always a pleasure.
You've been saying things on Twitter about Star Wars that have piqued my interest, so we'll get to all that in a minute.
Yeah.
Also with us, Jenny Josephson. Hello, Jenny.
Hello.
This might put you at number one and Ibbot in the back seat again.
Only because of the need to talk about Star Wars, but yeah. I will just say it's a temporary condition, and Ibbot is always number one in my heart.
All right, fine. Well, actually, technically you're tied, so it's a very equitable position to be in. It's fine. And joining us for the first time, perhaps not the last, TinVec.com's own Alex Hanna. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks. You know, it's nice to own my own website. It's handy nowadays.
It is, right?
It's possible.
Yeah, anything's possible. It's your own brand. Live it, love it, learn it. It's good to have you here, man. Thanks for hanging out with us and talking about Star Wars.
Well, I'm excited and spoiler filled, so they need to come out.
Well, good, because right now I'm playing this and it means all bets are off.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering. As do many others in high public office.
Gee, Tom, what's going on?
Well, Bob Iger told Bloomberg TV this morning that Episode 7's weekend ticket sales estimated to hit $528 million. That's higher than the $517 million you may have heard reported over the weekend. And it would put the film in front of Jurassic World's $524 million launch, which, by the way, included China. Star Wars The Force Awakens doesn't even come out in China until January 9th. So suffice to say, a lot of people spent money to go see this movie, and that's what we're going to talk about for this entire episode.
Yeah, and it feels like there shouldn't be anybody
the
listening.
The financials.
Yes,
I mean.
Yes.
Just talk about the financials.
One note on the financials. I would not be shocked if we saw that revised even higher later into the week, considering that a lot of that uptick number is the fact that people were adding showings to this movie all throughout the weekend, which is kind of harder because a lot of those estimates are really just that. They look at like what people are going to see it at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon and then just, you know, have whatever math that they have to draw it out. This is I think a very hard movie to track, but I mean, both domestically and internationally, I would not be shocked if this thing, if that number continues to climb higher for the opening weekend.
So what is, so it's, it broke every record that there was, right? Is there any that it didn't break? We were reading this morning, it was like 100 million, quickest 100 million, quickest to 200 million, faster, best Thursday opening, best IMAX opening, like every possible.
Biggest December debut, highest per theater average for a wide release, biggest IMAX debut, most pre-sales with over $100 million. Just, yeah, the list goes on.
Biggest what, Star Wars.
Biggest
Star
it was movie. Best opening for a Star Wars film.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, but what is it, does it, where did it sit pre-inflation, though?
Well, that's the question.
Adjusted for inflation makes a difference. Yeah, it didn't be Gone with the Wind. I know that.
Nothing's ever going to be Gone with the Wind.
Well, no, but I mean, like, for opening weekend, right? I mean, like, I wouldn't be shocked if Force Awakens beat A New Hope in opening weekend, because A New Hope didn't have opening.
Right.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Like, New Hope wouldn't have those kind of numbers because New Hope was
no, I think
new.
It only opened with 6 million or something roughly around there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was not in a lot of theaters when it opened, and then it kept, that's why it stayed in theaters so long, other than it being awesome, was that it had this incredibly slow rollout of the kind you see with independent films nowadays.
Mm. Yeah.
So let's toss around that idea
of you mean it went right to VOD?
Right. but with a movie this big and this huge and whatever, I don't think you can stop counting numbers anytime soon. I realize you can at some point say, all right, well, what represented opening weekend? But this thing's got legs, and if it was garbage, we could have a different discussion. But as it turns out, and unless anyone here wants to dissent, turns out Star Wars Episode 7 is not garbage. It's actually pretty good. It's actually real good. And it's good in the ways that I had hoped it would be. And I would love to go around before we get to any of the other nitty gritty here and just kind of see where everyone's at with it. A lot of people have said stuff on social media, at least expressed, you know, whether they liked it or not and that sort of thing. But I don't know that we've heard anything definitive from anyone on this panel. So, Jenny, do the honors. How did the person who was easily the most excited I've seen anyone about Star Wars feel about it now that you've seen it?
First of all, a little backdrop. I told you guys I went and bought 32 tickets at the Arclight for all of my friends. And so on Friday night at 8 o'clock, I sat there surrounded by not everyone I love, but a decent percentage of them all in a row. And we all watched Star Wars together. And I had been training myself by listening to the Star Wars theme so that I wouldn't cry when the big letters came on the screen. And I made it. I didn't cry, but I was transported. It occurred to me when the movie was over that I'm 39 years old. I'm straight up going to say it. This, believe it or not, is the first Star Wars movie I've ever seen in the theater on opening weekend that I loved.
Wow.
That I loved. It took 30, because I was too young for the first three to remember or even go to the first one. This, I came out of this movie filled with love and hope and tons of all the right questions about all the little and very purposefully left open threads in the movie. Those are there for a reason, right? Mm-hmm. And just a sense of profound relief that it was okay to love Star Wars again. Mm. And that is the takeaway for me. Like, all the love and the like, Star Wars was my babysitter when I was growing up. Like, when I was, you know, little latchkey kid in Brooklyn, like, I was watching Star Wars. And it was a profound sense of homecoming for me. And I am so excited for this universe to grow and be shaped by other directors. But, like, bravo, JJ. Bravo, writers. Bravo, everything. And there's lots of little other things we can say and questions we can have about it. But that overwhelming sense of gratitude and happiness is what stays with me.
They didn't screw you over. That's the feeling I got. And Alex, I'd love to hear your take. Where did you... You and I have only seen it once so far. So we have this... Oh, Jenny, before I forget, though.
Yes.
You're in the Arclight Theater. You weren't there when the projector freaked out.
Can you imagine 32 of my best friends and the projector goes down? That little clip of the people experiencing that moment of the projector breaking, my heart just broke for them. And
because it skipped ahead, right? Like 30
it
minutes
skipped ahead 15 minutes.
And they thought that was like the end, and they didn't know, and they were like, what the crap? And then the time reset, and they were super pissed. And yeah.
And that's not an Arclight thing to have happen. Yeah. I can't even conceive of that happening in our screening. So we were very lucky.
Good. I'm glad that worked out. Alex, your take.
No problem. That was a good question, because I had that question too when I heard you said you saw it at the Arclight. That's terrible.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I really like the movie. It's arguably not the best Star Wars. It's probably second, maybe third best Star Wars. It was arguable about second place. But anyway, it was really good, but it did what Star Wars does best for me, and that's create a world that I feel dropped into. You know, like, here's this world. I don't care what you know about it, what you want to know about it, whatever. We're going to show you the story. And it's so fun to feel that world feel really, really, really lived in, you know?
Yeah, it does have that world-building quality that another great film of 2015 has as well, where they don't have to spell everything out for you, despite...
Which film is that?
I can say it on this show, because it's only TMS that has the bet. It's Mad Max Fury Road, winner of many awards, and soon many more to come. So, Tom... I'm going last, by the way.
You made yourself like as if it's a controversial opinion. That, like, yeah.
It is among people I talk to.
Who are you talking to?
People think I'm crazy. Nicole Spagnuolo thinks I'm crazy. Brian Ibbett thinks I'm a little bit nuts on how sure I am it's going to win a bunch of awards. But I think what happened this year, this is a weird year for a lot of reasons for me, but all my entertainment was... I feel like we're at a place where I can't even fathom that we're here and that we're getting all the things we're getting. And you've given me a year, Hollywood, with Mad Max Fury Road, one of my favorite movies of the last 10 years easily, and one of my favorite movies of all time, and Star Wars Episode 7, a Star Wars movie that, A, didn't suck, more than that, was actually really good and has us talking about characters and storylines and mysteries of the universe and stuff that we haven't been able to talk about since the Muppet one, 6, right? We haven't really had a chance to do that. The prequels are not considered... people don't even really think of them as canon. And this episode is not going to be all about us making fun of Phantom Menace through the last one. We're not going to do that. But it bears mentioning, it's important to mention, that from the moment those yellow credits start, really from the moment the Lucasfilm logo started, till the end of that thing, I haven't had that much fun since the last Star Wars movie that was good. And my kids loved it, and my wife loved it, and my daughter couldn't stop crying afterwards for reasons we'll get to in a minute. Like, all those things. So, Justin, let's go to you next. You've had things to say. Where are you at with Star Wars?
So, first things first, I really, and it's been touched on a little bit, I just, what I think now processing it, a lot of my dread going into the movie was like, I just didn't want another civil war in amongst fandom, like, mm-hmm. where it was like just this binary argument of, did you think the movie sucked? No, then you're crazy. Mm-hmm. Right. There mm-hmm. was really, it was like just this weird toxic element of Star Wars that was kind of always there. And every time somebody did, it's Yoda singing Taylor Swift, we can all laugh about it. And then somebody, is like, oh, well, yeah, the prequels suck. And it's like, I don't know, the prequels were great. And then it's like this big, ugly fight. Even what people would consider to be, controversy about this movie now, like, I love every element of that. Like, I love the fact that, like, we're actually having substantive conversations about depths of character and what was a cheap writer's ploy versus a decision to limit the scope of the movie. What was what was handled poorly? What was handled well? The fact that this movie stands up or invites that kind of scrutiny is so amazing to me. And I love it. And it's just so great. As far as my own opinion on the movie, man, I've seen it twice and I had a great time both times. I just walked out of the movie grinning ear to ear. It very much, to me, feels aside from inside the Star Wars universe, it feels script wise a lot like a lot of the Marvel movies that have come out recently. It feels like a script that had gone through typical to both Marvel and Pixar, you know, the million rewrites to make sure that every little moment, if it can have a joke or an aside, has a joke or an aside to keep things going forward. It seems like a movie that was cut down a lot, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of other stuff that feels like, well, is this too much like a 15-minute conversation about trade routes? Cut it. Like, we'd rather leave things to be mysterious. Like, why do we care about that entire system getting blown up? Like, they'd rather leave the question than have a bunch of people saying, well, you know, the Galactic Senate has just moved through their final thing, and there is this intrigue about the First Order. Don't you worry, Senator. The First Order is not a threat. Like, they would rather skip all that and just have the planet blow up and have us get back to the people that we really care about, then give us that context, which I think is open to a good discussion on whether or not that was done too much or the movie was cut too bare. But I had a great time, man. I love those characters. And even all the stuff that you could say, and you could be critical of it, to me, the hardest part, the biggest challenge in the movie, and you've even seen in some of the interviews with Michael Arndt, the original screenwriter, was that, like, they needed to sell you on the new characters. Mm. And I left that theater loving all four leads. I love Kylo Ren. I love Finn. I love Rey. I love Poe. Kylo Ren, to me, has, I don't know the last time that I've consistently kept thinking about a movie character like I have Kylo Ren. He's just such a fascinating, interesting, fun character to me. Mm-hmm. And it's like, listen, Star Wars has always been defined by the villain. It's always, you know, as good as the hero is, you got it is defined by the big bad. Mm-hmm. And Kylo Ren, to me, I'm so pumped to see where this journey goes over the next two films.
Yeah, he was super interesting, and it goes to the point earlier about world building without explaining too much. I was able to fill in a lot of blanks in my own head about his childhood, his upbringing, why he would rebel like this, what that all must have been like, why this is so hard from a parental point of view, and why he is trying so hard to equal that of his, what turns out to be his grandfather. Again, if you're still here, people, and you haven't seen the movie, spoilers, all right? Get the hell out of the chat room. Don't be here for this. Tom, the big man on campus, the guy who's seen it thrice or twice?
Three times now.
Where'd you land? What do you think? And then we'll get into the nitty of the gritty.
Yeah, it was all right. No, I'm just kidding. You don't go back and say, there have been three movies in the past several years that I saw twice. And Star Wars The Force Awakens is one of them. I saw the original Avengers movie twice, meaning I went and saw it. And a couple weeks later, I went and saw it again because it was so fun. Guardians of the Galaxy, I went and saw it. And I went back the next week and saw it again because it was so fun. Star Wars The Force Awakens, I already pre-ordered two showings, which could have been a mistake. Yeah. It wasn't. And I went back a third time. Part of that was because I was doing that pretend I'm dumb about Star Wars series, and I needed to watch the movie when I wasn't with anyone else or bothering anyone else and sitting in the back of the theater. But I didn't mind. I wanted that excuse to go see it a third time. I've been thinking about this a lot, and part of me is saying, well, it's the seventh movie in a series, right? And how many movies that can do a series like that can bring a seventh movie out and make you like it? And we got another example of that this year with Creed, obviously. James Bond is always cited, but that's not a linear series, right? It just kind of pops around and reinvents itself all the time. So that's a really tough thing to do. And I think they did it really well. I had a smile on my face the whole time. I super enjoyed the movie. I was, the first time through, confused about what they were blowing up, because it looked like Coruscant, but then I knew it wasn't Coruscant because they said it was something else, but then I wasn't sure. The attack on the Starkiller base confused me the first time around because there wasn't the clear, like, you have to shoot this exhaust port and blow it up, or you have to shoot the core and blow it up. I'm like, did they blow it up or not? Like, going back and seeing it again, all those confusions were evaporated and I loved it. But what I came to the conclusion yesterday, after doing Pretend I'm Dumb About Star Wars for this, was that what George Lucas wanted to do with the first Star Wars was take us back to the magic of what his generation enjoyed about serials like Flash Gordon. He wanted to recapture your youth with Star Wars. And he did it to such success that me, as a seven-year-old, absolutely adored it too. I feel like what J.J. Abrams did with The Force Awakens was what George Lucas wanted to do for his generation. He took us back to our youth. Mm. And what our youth loved was watching Star Wars. Mm. And so he has Star Wars'd Star Wars by letting us have a movie that recaptures that feeling in a way that isn't just a like Flash Gordon, the movie was just kind of, you know, an homage to the serial. This was much more than that. It was something that sent you new characters and gave you new things. So you weren't thinking, oh, okay, well, this is just the same old thing, trotted out another time, but still gave you lots of those beats that you enjoyed. Maybe a few too many, maybe not. Depends on who you talk to. But I just think it was overall a fantastic success for what it was. Was it a great movie, quote unquote? No. It's not the kind of movie I think stands alone and can be held up in a way like you could argue Mad Max Fury Road is. Mm. I don't think Star Wars The Force Awakens is that. I don't think it was meant to be, and I loved every minute of
it. Yeah, and I'm going to throw out something a little bit controversial to some, maybe not us, but I want all of us to just jump in where you feel like jumping in on this. But you bring up points that reminded me of this question, and it kept hitting me during the movie, and I never minded. I want to make this very clear. This was something I liked about the movie, but it's kind of a retelling of New Hope in many,
it's
many,
like a
many
remix,
ways.
Right?
It is a remix, exactly. And not just that. There are portions of Empire that show up. When that lightsaber was stuck in the snow, it was clearly there and evoking this memory of Luke being stuck in the cave at the beginning of Empire. There were lots of little nods like that, little things that were clearly setups for stuff we'd seen before or felt before. But then, like you said, remix, like, you know, what is Rey if not basically?
I think that there is certainly an argument to be said. And for some people who are like, oh, this is a shot or scene by scene, a remake, you know, or like that. It's like Psycho remake.
Right. Gus Van Sant. Yeah. That thing was scene by scene. Right.
Yeah, like shot by shot. Yeah. I think that is people trying to get a little too clever, you know, and certainly evocative, right? Mm-hmm. Desert born hero, droid with the secret plans, you know, finds old sage person who's seen it all to guide them. Yeah, I mean, you can find those. It's there. I think there is a criticism to be made of the movie that J.J. Abrams and Lawrence Kasdan might have decided to play it safe, you know, but at the same time, I really don't blame them. And I think they would rather have the highest grossing movie of all time that has a huge Rotten Tomatoes rating that now sets up two Star Wars movies a year forever. Then they take a big artistic risk that either from the screen to the shooting to the editing to the acting doesn't pay off like they wanted it.
Well, plus,
when a patient breaks their leg, mm-hmm. right? Like a franchise breaks its leg three times in the same place. You got to fix the leg before that franchise can dance again. And I feel like this was the table setter that saved, in my mind, Star Wars. It set the table with a bunch of amazing things.
Splint? Is that what you're
saying? Yes, the splint awakened. Okay. it set so many amazing things that went off in this direction, in that direction, and it achieved to me a really difficult thing. And yes, J.J. Abrams is a nostalgia supercomputer, okay? He's like, boop, 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 put this here, doot, 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 this here. Bringing in Lawrence Kasdan, who's the only guy to ever really beautifully write a Star Wars movie and did it, you know, to perfection in Empire. Like, everything in here is designed for this movie to take us in its arms, be like, it's okay now, it's okay. Now, it's very wise that J.J. Abrams is not directing than any more of these movies, to have a hand at the wheel and be producing, but to let people create and craft a vision going forward, I think is a really wise idea. But this movie had a lot of things to do. I think it did it really well. I agree with you, though, that as a movie, I think you could pick it apart the same way that after repeated viewings, you could start to pick apart Star Trek 2009.
And, oh, yeah, you know, easily. And the sequel even more so. And I only really brought that up as to make the point of J.J. is known for this. Like the Star Trek series, this reboot of Star Trek is a remixing of the original TOS. And in very literal ways, the second one is a rewriting of the Khan story. And so when I saw some of these things start to pop on screen, two things happened. I went, oh, yeah, this is totally something J.J. Abrams would do. Secondly, I thought, good, because that's the guy that needed to make this thing and have it speak to me the way it needed to speak to me, unlike the way that the prequels did. And Jenny, to your point, I really like what you just said. To your point about J.J.'s the right guy for this reboot or this restart, and the wrong guy for the remaining two of the at least of this series, I agree with that. In the same way that George Lucas was the right guy for four, and I forgot his name, second guy for the third, and third guy for Kirshner. Yeah, Kirshner. Yeah. Those guys were the right guys for what came next. Kasdan was the right guy to write the script. Like that is absolutely true, and if he, like back when they said, "Oh, I'm just doing the one," I went, "Oh, well, that's too bad. I'd like to see him continue on." Actually, I don't think I do. I think I'd let him be, you know, the creative force he's going to be. Let him be the behind the scenes guy on all these other projects plus his own projects. But don't force him to do it. Let's see what that brick director can do with a darker second, you know, with a darker middle act.
Although, by the way, the pressure on Rian Johnson now, because this movie has a legitimate shot based on initial trajectory to be the highest grossing movie on time and have a shot for the first time ever for a movie to come close to $1 billion domestic. Now we talk about Avengers movies. We talk about, any sequel to a film is, oh, this might be the Empire Strikes Back of this. Like it's shorthand for the great sequel that takes it in a different, fun, artistically challenging direction. Mm-hmm. He literally has to direct the Empire Strikes Back. He's the guy to do it. I mean, like, look at J.J. Abrams, not including Star Wars The Force Awakens. You would say, in whatever order you want, his best three films are Mission Impossible 3, Star Trek, and I'll put Star Trek Into Darkness over Super 8, but you can sub that in if you want.
Yeah.
Rian Johnson's done three films before he starts shooting Episode 8, which is Brick, The Brothers Bloom, and Looper. Those are three better films. That's a better resume than J.J. Abrams for my money. And they are very different, character-driven, contemplative kind of movies. So you assume we're going to breathe a little bit more in the sequel than we are in the Force Awakens, which is pretty much, you know, moves about as fast as J.J. likes to move his cameras during transitions. So we'll see. You know, I mean, this is... Let's go back to episode 7, but like the pressure on this guy is intense.
And I think JJ has given him a jump ball, right?
Yeah.
And you alluded to this earlier, Justin. Michael Arndt had a script at one point. He said that where Luke Skywalker shows up mid movie, Rey goes and finds him and then they set off together. And I can't remember if it was Michael or JJ who said it, but every time they did that, no matter where in the movie they did it, Luke Skywalker took over and Rey faded into the background. And that was the instinct they had that I think was 100% right, which is we never want that to happen.
Yeah.
We want the new characters to always be leading the action and up in front and the older characters supporting them where it's necessary. And they did a great balancing act with Han Solo, with Harrison Ford, because they gave him lots to do, but it was all in the service of Rey and Finn. So you never felt like Han was taking over the scene. You felt like he was one of their crew, and they handled that well. And so as heartbreaking for J.J. Abrams as it must have been to leave Mark Hamill out of the majority of this movie, he has given Rian the ball by saying, all right, now you get Luke.
Yeah, you figure it out.
Yeah.
No, but what I loved about it is that Han Solo, and I'm assuming we're going to get to that thing we have to talk about.
Yeah,
we have
to talk about it, yeah.
But Han Solo has always been the setback guy in every movie that he's been in, the character that is always observing what's going on with other characters. Yes, he's doing a lot of stuff. He's always the audience's point of view on the movie that he's in. Yeah. And this is no different. And they did it so beautifully and so heartbreakingly. He is always the POV of these, the best thing about these Star Wars movies.
By the way, how weird is it, considering how derided Mark Hamill's acting is in A New Hope, that he's always thought to be the least polished actor in those three films, that now would anybody object that he's easily the best actor out of Carrie Fisher, Harrison Ford?
Well, they don't give him anything to do and nothing to say yet, so we'll see in episode 8.
He looked fantastic.
But he looked amazing.
I mean, sure.
Not in this movie. I just mean in general. Like, I mean, in
really, you think he's better than Harrison Ford now?
Yeah.
I was going to say, I'd argue like Harrison Ford.
Yeah, I will. I will. Harrison Ford is the most alive I've seen him in the past 10 years in this movie. And
fair enough. That's fair. True. That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah, since the 90s.
Parts where it's just like, all right, like, you know, it is the chopped and screwed version of Han Solo, where it's just
put the trickster from the Flash next to Crystal Skull, and I'm 100% on board with what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I mean, that's my point is just that I'm so excited to see Mark Hamill, who has continued to expand his acting range since Star Wars. You know, he's worked a lot. I mean, he's been the most workaday actor. Harrison Ford's been playing some degree of Harrison Ford since what, 85, right?
Since American Graffiti, really.
Yeah. If you want to get right down to it. Yeah.
You know, Carrie Fisher, bless her heart. I wanted to see Princess Leia that was a lot more like Carrie Fisher. My favorite princess.
Carrie Fisher is the best Princess Leia.
Oh my God. Princess Leia that, like, you know, is telling Rey, you know, as Carrie Fisher apparently told Daisy Ridley, hey, don't burn through the crew like wildfire. Like, you know, I would love to see Carrie Fisher respond to Han Solo, her husband, who, you know, their relation, or, you know, I don't know, baby daddy, whose relationship dissolved and is now just going back to drug dealing. I would love to see Carrie Fisher and not Princess Leia respond to him showing back up while she's very busy at work. Because I would assume it would be a torrent of anger and sass, the likes of which Carrie Fisher dishes out. And I kind of wanted a little bit more of that in Leia.
Yeah, she was a little muted.
Pretty stoic. But on the other hand, I don't know that
she
I need her yelling,
has been.
Get the big, you know, to get this big dirty carpet out of my way or whatever she said before.
Yeah, guys, we have to talk about Han Solo.
Okay, let's talk about it. Alex, any other thoughts before we move on to that?
I wanted to give you a real quick. The issue on it being kind of a repeat of A New Hope, I actually think is important to the storyline as a whole. It's history repeating itself, not in exactly the same way. But it's the same type of thing that it's like, hey, our parents went through this. Your parents are going to go through that, you know, like so on and so forth. And I feel like that part of the story, it adds a lot to the previous stories, even to know that this is happening yet again.
Yeah, I agree. It resonates as a Star Wars tale. It resonates with this kind of saga this thing is. And like Tom said, does it stand up as a standalone movie compared to other movies in a vacuum or something? Probably not, but as a Star Wars tale, it was pitch perfect. Like, it's dead on.
And a great example of that is the remix. I'm sorry, Alex, go ahead.
No, I just said, yeah, I absolutely agree.
The remix is apparent in Han Solo's last scene.
Mm-hmm.
He is the old mentor going to face the evil, but it's not against his apprentice. He's walking out on a catwalk to do battle, but not with lightsabers. There is someone who yells Ben, but it's not Luke Skywalker. It's Han to his own son. Yeah. And then that is the point where it's revealed what his son's name actually was. So it's all the elements of A New Hope, but they're repositioned and rearranged in my opinion, very well to say, like, this is calling you back to something you experienced before. And the heartbreak of seeing Obi-Wan Kenobi, who you just got to know, be killed, but with an entirely different character and with much more weight.
Ratcheted up, because you got Obi-Wan who's lived a long life. He's done a lot of things in the Force. He's the guy. He's been around forever. And he willingly takes that final blow from Vader because he knows it's the thing he has to do at this stage of his arc. Whereas Han Solo is now having the most crushing experience you can have. A wayward son who's not just wayward, like wayward in the worst way, like is becoming the next horrible nemesis of the galaxy, or at least trying, you know, desperately to. And there they are. That's way worse. You know, it's way worse. And it's a betrayal that's much, much worse. And at the end of all of that, well, the minute he yelled Ben, my daughter started crying because I think she knew the writing on the wall. And then we couldn't console her after all this. This was rough for her. She, and the place she really went down was when Chewie reacted. That was really hard for her to deal with.
I'd say this, the weight of this, that scene is probably more than when Vader reveals himself to be Luke Skywalker's father in the first movie. I mean, that's a huge, I mean, he's getting his hand cut off. He's fallen out of this big, you know, pipe down like to arguably nothing, but he got caught in an intent, you know, like all sorts of stuff is going on in that scene. And this one scene between these two characters that, I mean, it sat there on just them for like 10 minutes. It felt like, you know, just the scene went on for not in a bad way, went on forever, but it felt like there was just so much to explore in the scene.
Yeah, there really was. And to have the light, the symbology of the light going out as that conversation led to what it led to. And you could see in Kylo Ren's face that this isn't all just him passing his evil Sith test or whatever the crap it was. He's torn up, whether he's admitting it or not. He's just at that place where he's gone far enough. It's like when, you know, Anakin kills all the kids, to bring up a prequel moment. That's kind of a point of no return. For Vader, right. You could argue this was clearly a point of no return. And again, I think JJ and others are, you know, effectively and purposely trying to make callbacks that make you resonate with previous films and with previous characters.
Oh, absolutely. And this is like, just to go real quick to your point of no return, he's been looking for it, you know, like throughout the movie, he's trying not to be the good guy. And he, you know, it's very, very obvious that he's like, hey, I need to embrace this dark side because I keep having these, you know, good thoughts. It's kind of like the opposite of somebody who's trying to be good, you know. Mm-hmm. But this is, and that's why he say thank you or something. I need to see the damn movie again.
Yeah, he thanks him.
Yeah.
Well, and I thought it was beautifully played, where you definitely see indecision. You see real pain on his face. You see him think, I would really like to not do this. And it's a real moment where it's not, can't be explained by, oh, he was pretending to want to be saved by his dad in order to fool him. No, he is at a point of truly not knowing what is going to happen next himself.
Yep.
Is he going to give in and go back to his dad and forgive him? And something happens and he decides not to. And that's the moment the decision is made, when the lightsaber comes on. And
it's intense.
Yeah.
I actually read that a little bit more sinister than you did, Tom. I viewed him suckering his dad in so he could have the killing blow.
It's funny. Eileen saw it that way the first time we saw it. And then the second time we saw it, she's like, I totally saw it the opposite way this time, which was him almost giving into the light. And pulling out.
That's a element of the story, and it's certainly set up by the fact that he is, you know, at his shrine to granddaddy, you know, talking about how much, you know, he needs to focus and not give in to the light, you know.
Hold on, I have to ask grandpa's head.
I view that, I mean, certainly it is hard. He is getting over something, but I saw that scene as his resolution holding.
Well, and I think that's the brilliance of the scene, is that you perfectly legitimately can see it that way.
Sure, yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
Like, it definitely lets you project onto it in really interesting ways.
It's a strong performance, and he gets a bunch of credit for this, I think. Adam Driver does. He's really, really good.
Subtle. I would say that for everyone going on about J.J. Abrams just remixing Star Wars and redoing this, he took the most beloved character in the Star Wars canon, the one that everybody loves, and he stabbed him through the abdomen. And that takes, I'm sorry for the pun, guts.
Well, yeah, it takes guts,
and
but
I
let's
thought
not
it smelled bad on the end.
Oh no.
But let's not forget one really important part of that. Remember when, back in the day, by everyone's admission, including Harrison Ford's, he demanded at the end of Jedi that Lucas let his character die, and Lucas refused. He's like, he's too heroic. I can't let a character like Han Solo perish. We're not going to let it happen. Plus, we have plans for other stuff. It's just not going to happen. And he didn't like that. It always bugged him. And the talk floating around, and all this is on blogs and stuff, so who knows if any of it's true, but is that he had said to JJ, look, if you guys are going to have me in this, if I'm doing this, you're going to grant my freaking wish, and you're going to let my character go.
It was absolutely right for the story.
Yeah.
It was absolutely right for the story.
Completely agree. Yeah. It caught me way off guard, though, because part of me said, you never kill Han Solo. He's never gone. He's always in this.
All of us felt that.
Yeah.
It's, you know, we felt that tension. Is he not going to? He might not. Oh, we all see what's going to happen, but maybe they're going to twist it. And, you know,
But that is how our culture and our dramas and our comedies and everything, that is how storytelling has changed from the last time we had a Star Wars movie to now. You can kill anybody in the service of a story.
Thank you,
George R. R. Martin. Thank you, Sopranos. Thank you, Walking Dead. Like, that is just the rule. Nobody is safe, or else you're not telling the story you need to tell if that's your world.
I mean, it's also wrestling booking 101. You got a new guy. You got to put him over. So you have an old legend come back. He kills the legend. Now he's the legend killer. Like, this is, you know, in the parlance of wrestling booking, it's called the rub. Kylo Ren got the rub.
And it perfectly sets up episode 10 when we find out that they've recovered Han's body and it's in Maz Kanata's castle in a chest.
Ooh, I want to talk about her for a second. She was awesome. I freaking loved that character. And this is, so see, there's another thing that JJ did. He went ahead in 2015, and we've clearly made big strides since 99, but still, in 2015, he made a movie with a purely CGI-created character, 100% CGI, and I freaking loved her. She was
two major all CGI.
That's characters. True. The dude at the barter dude at the beginning that was always buying her junk for not.
No, I'm thinking of Snoke.
Oh yeah, and Snoke. I forgot about.
Oh no, barter dude was a practical.
Yeah.
Well, the face was animated, though.
He might have had an animated face. By the way, is that Simon Pegg?
Yes.
Yeah,
that was Simon Pegg.
Did you guys figure out who? Did you guys figure out who James Bond was? We figured it out this morning.
I read it later. I didn't figure it out.
I had no idea.
When I went back the second time, I heard his voice doing an American accent. It was very hard to pick up, but I did catch that.
What I knew about it.
Yeah.
It was, you had to know to really tune in to the stormtrooper that Rey first forced.
Yeah. If you're not knowing what we're talking about, it's when she kind of figures out what she can do and talks this stormtrooper into letting her go.
And by the way, possibly an echo to her parentage?
A little bit, maybe. Okay, let's talk about that.
I don't even think you have to hedge on that.
Let's talk about that, because there's a lot of people saying they'll be disappointed if Rey is Luke's daughter. A lot of people saying, well, maybe she's actually Han and Leia's daughter, and they were mind wiped, and nobody remembers it for whatever reason.
I would be very annoyed if they were mind wiped.
I think it's very clear that she's Luke's daughter.
Yes, I'm on that.
There are several reasons. She's an amazing pilot, like Anakin and Luke. She is very strong in the Force, like Anakin and Luke. She also, every time she picked up Luke's lightsaber, you heard Luke's theme.
Yeah.
Which could be just like, well, yeah, it's Luke's lightsaber, except it's Anakin's lightsaber.
Yeah.
And especially in the moment where she's pushed to the edge and Kylo says, I will train you in the Force. And she says, the Force. And you hear Luke's theme again, and she starts fighting like Luke. Mm. So either it's a big old hoodwink, or they're like clearly pointing out. Also, teaser trailer number 2, the voiceover is Mark Hamill saying, the Force runs strong in my family. My sister has it. I have it. You have that power too. Who the hell is he talking about?
Yeah. That's a good point. Yep.
And the beauty of that, the beauty of Tom's theory, which I 110% agree with, is that it can mean only one thing for this number one extended universe fan, which is that there is a Mara Jade and she is the mom. End of story.
Hey,
no other question.
A lot of thoughts that Benicio del Toro will be Grand Admiral Thrawn in the next
movie.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Or a Thrawn-esque character, which I think.
Or a Snoke Thrawn.
An amazing thing. I don't think it's Luke. I don't think she's Luke.
All right. Convince
me. Give us your take.
I don't think so either, but I'll go ahead.
Who did that Force trick in episode 4? Not episode 6, episode 4.
The Force trick? Oh, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Obi-Wan.
How could that be?
How could Obi-Wan Kenobi be? That's 30-something years ago.
Satine in the Clone Wars, which is canon, has a little relationship with Obi-Wan. It's left unknown whether it was ever consummated off-screen.
Yeah, but in that, in Clone Wars, that was set many, many, many years before any of this.
And now that would pit Darth Vader's granddaughter or grandson against Obi-Wan's granddaughter.
I think we're violating Occam's razor here.
Oh, stop. Wait, come on. Listen. And number one, you're actually right, because the fact that, like, that a Star Wars movie would fail to turn literally everybody into a Skywalker at every first available chance, of course, right? Because that's all they ever do is reveal. Like, it's like, you know, finding out that somebody in Star Wars is a Skywalker was like finding out somebody was a Cylon in Battlestar Galactica. Eventually, we're all Skywalkers.
Yeah.
But I would be very happy if you know, if you're going to keep it, quote unquote, in the family, right? And you're going to have it be somebody, I would prefer it to be in the Kenobi lineage and not necessarily the Skywalker lineage.
Well, then it would have to be Kenobi's offspring, who is then her progenitor. It'd have to be a parent.
Yeah, she would be a granddaughter.
Yeah, right. it can't be old man Kenobi.
Let's be clear about something. It's the Skywalker family, Anakin, Luke. Everybody's still talking about balance in this Star Wars Force Awakens. And so if they're talking about balancing the Force, I think they're talking about the Skywalkers, and I think she's got to be a Skywalker.
And Ben is a Skywalker.
And Ben is a Skywalker, too, and they're cousins, and they have a weird attraction, which makes it like they had chemistry, those two. Let's talk about it. Like, the Driver and her were facing off, forcing off, and you felt these weird Lucas-y sparks in all the weird places.
Yeah, I don't know if it felt, I mean, I didn't feel any sort of like attraction kind of thing between them.
No, but it was like.
But I felt more like here, maybe this supports your theory, because I actually kind of hate the idea that it would end up being Luke's kid, just because it seems too rote.
It's too easy.
It's too easy. But one other thing that maybe supports that is that when she, so they depict her as a little girl being left on the planet,
right?
Jakku, and then they take off and leave her there, and she's left to sort of fend for herself. It kind of makes sense to me in the other bits of story that we know about Luke, which is at some point he realizes, oh crap, this isn't going to work. I've created a monster with Kylo Ren. I've got to leave and isolate myself. I need to be the last Jedi and get my powers out of everyone's hair, or whatever his reason to go to that island is. And it makes sense to say, if you had kids, or if she was just a trainee, this is an idea too. If she was a trainee of these children that were being raised to be new Jedi, to repopulate the Jedi world, that they would all be scattered about to protect them and put them in places where they can't be found, or they won't be sought out by evil forces. So it makes sense.
Like he and Leia were.
Exactly. The same idea. Exactly. So it wouldn't surprise me if they're just repeating that.
But doesn't, I mean, like, also, I kind of have the feeling that Luke would have the sort of boy named Sue thoughts of, you know, like being abandoned on a desert planet for his own, you know, his own best interest. Or it's like, yes, true. Okay, I understood why you did it. But if I ever had the chance to do it with my own children, no, a forest, a city, anywhere, but far from the universe.
He may not know. Mom may have hidden her. He may not know. The T-Glass, 1976, made an excellent point that Rey may have been hidden and Luke may not have known that she was born yet. So there's all sorts of interesting narrative twists, but let's just be clear that if it's any other answer, it defies the whole remixing of this series.
That's true, but if she knows what that saber is before she sees it and has flashbacks about it, and the little Kanata lady's telling her, you know, this means whatever, and they, you know, if you've seen it before, you know, it means something. Well, she either saw it because she was training with it, or she saw it because it was her dad's. Right?
So is Maz Kanata related to Jeff Kanata?
I think so, in lots of ways.
Fairly certain. They have the same eyes.
Yeah, neither one saw trailers before the movie came out. That was the other thing.
No, I call the whole lightsaber thing just the Force. There's the and I haven't watched all the cartoons, but there's talk in them about the crystals that run the lightsabers having not personality, but they take on a lot of what happens to the people that are using them. And to me, somebody who's force sensitive, like I want to argue Finn is, and we can talk about that afterwards, that especially somebody who's arguably as strong as Rey is supposed to be, that lightsaber would hit her like a ton of bricks, like it did. You know, it's so much involved in it.
It showed her a corridor from Bespin.
Bespin. Sorry, Cloud City. Yeah.
Yeah, Cloud City. Well, yes, not Bespin. Correct. Cloud City, which is an orbit around Bespin. And it shows her, it shows several other scenes. We get an awesome bit of Alec Guinness's voice saying Rey, cool, which is taken from Don't Be Afraid that he says to R2-D2. We get actually Ewan McGregor's voice saying,
which I didn't catch.
Rey came from Betray, from Your Thoughts Betray.
No, it came from Don't Be Afraid to R2-D2. At least that's what they said. And then we get Yoda's voice. But I think the most intriguing scene is there's one where she is herself in perspective. So you don't know if it's her being a little girl or her being someone else. But there's a guy about to club her and Kylo Ren kills him and saves her. So one of the other big debates is that her remembering being a little girl and Kylo Ren actually saves her because they're cousins and he still hasn't fully gone over the dark? Or is she remembering Luke almost being killed and Kylo Ren? But whoever it was, whatever perspective she was from, Kylo Ren stopped this other person from killing her.
Yeah. And this is, Jenny, I want you to answer whatever you're going to say. I want you to say it. But before I do, I just want to revel in the moment and say, Justin's right. Isn't it nice to have a Star Wars movie where this kind of talk can happen? We haven't had this for 30 years where we can talk about this weird, like the tapestry and the what ifs and the who was that. And I don't know. It could mean this. I haven't been able to do that in so long. It feels freaking great. It feels great.
This conversation happens story-wise because of three scenes. One in the very first scene in the movie, just that entire thing, but specifically the interactions between Kylo Ren and Poe Dameron, where it's like that first scene is everything that we didn't get in the prequels stuffed. It is like a big, loud declaration that guess what? You're going to get fun where people talk to each other. We're not going to start the movie where two people sit in a room and wait for tea. You are going to get consequences and violence and stakes, the likes of which we did not see in the entire prequels. In fact, the only time that we ever see people get gratuitously violent, it is Anakin killing the Sand People, killing General...
Tusken Tatooineans. Justin.
Yeah, sure, exactly. Sorry to use that slur. Killing the younglings in the Jedi Temple. So that's the first one. Just Poe Dameron and Kylo Ren going back and forth and having this like awesome thing and that some really fun sci-fi like stopping the laser blast using the Force. Number two, Finn and Poe escaping the ship. Back and forth, banter. I care about this person. I care about this other person. And more importantly, it's the movie showing, hey, look, we have a script that cares about fun and characters and investing you in these people. And finally, the scene with Finn and Rey on the Millennium Falcon when he is trying to negotiate with BB-8 to keep his secret but reveal where they need to go. And, just all that. It's like, as soon as that scene is over, you're like, oh my God, I love all these three characters because of those three scenes. This is so fun. And that's all before Han Solo shows up.
Yeah.
Solo. I just want to jump in and say, like, how great is it to have not only just a strong female character, the way that you had Carrie Fisher back in 1976 and all throughout the movies, but clearly the lead of the movie is this amazing, strong woman. I mean, I know everybody's talking about, we don't need to talk about it for a long time, but for me, that was so huge. She is Furiosa in the Star Trek world. She is capable. She is strong. She's always leading and moving forward. She is never asking for help. It made me so, and she's funny.
She was never in a position where any of these guys needed to save her. They were in positions often where she could do it for them. And I came away from that thinking, I went to the movie thinking, all right, well, these, I don't even know these new people. I don't know how they're going to fit in here, whatever, whatever. I will keep an open mind. And I walked out putting her in my top two or three Star Wars characters of all time.
Let's get into let's get into this discussion though. This is now I'm leaving the podcast. Now I'm entering in as a foil for this argument.
Uh-oh, the advocate devil's general called. It's Justin.
Justin Robert Young is dead.
Oh, Supreme.
This is ArguCon.
internet argument. Rey is overpowered. Rey doesn't face enough hardship. Rey doesn't earn her success. Rey is, in the parlance of fan fiction, a Mary Sue, i.e. somebody that comes from a low rank. Does not is always forgiven for anything that she does and is inexplicably skilled in every element of the plot, therefore rendering the stakes less than they could be and creating a boring story.
Well, if I was a male pig, yes, I'd agree with you 100%. But since I'm not,
the idea of a Mary Sue is not a, although it lends itself very perfectly to be a gender slayer. It is not in its idea. It is, you know, not a gender based thing. It is a idea. It is a crappy character that was begun with fan fiction of people just writing themselves that here's a 20,000 word story where somebody that is very much like me, all of a sudden has all the skills to run the Enterprise, and at the end of it, Captain Kirk is high-fiving me.
All right, here's what I would say then. So here's two things I would say. One, then everyone is. Then Luke is, then everyone is. The only person that maybe isn't is Han Solo, and his arc has always been the more realistic approach. But these charmed life people with the powers and the whatnot, that's them. He lost a hand, he got a better robot hand. Okay, that's about as bad as it ever got for Luke, as far as we know. What's the difference? She was thrown on this thing. She had a hard life. She had to scrap and figure stuff out for herself. I don't get it. I don't get why people think that she is this, that she is this problem, or that
she's
it is a problem.
She's also a product of the movie that she's in, which is, I think that if she was, like, say Rey was in the Mad Max movie, she might be a different character. But the whole point of these Star Wars movies is that they're the Flash Gordon serials, right? So you're not, I think it's too much to ask. I think you may see her gain depth or gain character or whatever, but I was, as a lady, I was fine with it. I don't think about the Mary Sue part of it. I don't think about that. I see a character I relate to that I love, who's capable, who's not held back by things, and that clearly has a lot of inner pain that they're not even dealing with directly in the movie, but it's there. I feel it. I feel that pain for her.
Does everyone have to be jacked up like Walter White? Can't we have some heroes again that are pure of heart?
So this just to clarify where this argument is. This argument isn't necessarily about pain. It is about the process for which she earns her success, right? And so the argument that would be there is that Luke runs away from things. Luke shows that he is scared and overwhelmed at times in A New Hope. And yes, despite the fact that he uses these nascent force powers to focus his aim and shoot into the one tiny convenient plot device that explodes this gigantic Death Star, which, if we're going to talk about convenient plot devices, I mean, come on, the fact that there's one thing that ruins the entire Death Star if you shoot from space
again
is there, right? But he has moments of weakness that for Rey knows how to fly the Millennium Falcon better than Han Solo does. Rey really only at one point gets kind of cornered and brought into the keeping of the First Order, and then through heretofore unknown means channels the Force better than our hero after three movies did using her the Force trick.
Maybe it's because she has two Force-sensitive parents, one of whom is named Mara Jade!
Which is fine, right? But the argument would be you can't escape the criticism by saying maybe there'll be more, right? You need to show it. If you're going to criticize this movie, that if that is not there, then that is this criticism. Now, I can go and argue about my criticism, but I'll let you guys go.
She's Anakin without the problems, though.
No, here, hold on. I want to reset the parameters of this discussion because this really bothers me. Mm-hmm. Mary Sue is a term for an author inserting themselves into a piece of fan fiction without any consequences and being heroic for everything. It has now become, over the years, not just on the internet, but over the years, an insult that you throw at an author you don't like or someone you don't think is very good. And it is especially used prejudicially against female characters and female authors. So I think Justin's bringing up the discussion because it's happening and also because it's worth exploring. Like, hey, is Rey a little OP? You know, is it believable? But she is not Mary Sue. It is offensive to call her Mary Sue because she is not, she doesn't do everything perfectly.
She runs away.
She is not J.J. Abrams' wish fulfillment. She is a character that does some things and does other things not so well. And I'm really, really tired of this Mary Sue bullshit. I'll be honest. Like, just don't, just stop it.
I am with Tom Merritt on
anytime
this.
Anytime you don't like something, you can't just call it Mary Sue.
Yeah.
Okay. Is Rey overpowered is a legitimate discussion, which is what we're having.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Me down with all.
All I know is that I want to be Rey. I wish I could have been Rey growing up. I want to be Rey now. I want to feel like that. And I hope that every single little girl who ever sees this movie feels the same way. And it makes me cry with happiness every time I think about it. So if that's where we are as a culture, is that we need overpowered women in these central roles for a decade or so, fine by me.
Yeah, I can tell you as a father of two girls, it is there's something a little extra special about that. You see that and you go, this is what I want. This is the attitude. This is the attitude. This is the aspiration. This is the kind of hero I want them to look at in their fictional fandom. Like I had growing up too. I had similar kinds of things that were on the male side of things, but they were there. Luke was one of them. Han Solo was one of them. These were my guys, right? I want them to have somebody like that. I don't want any more damsels in distress. I don't want somebody who fits the trope of a billion movies before. I want somebody who can kick trash, is conflicted, it's hard, they overcome great things. That's an amazing thing to want to teach your kids. So anybody who talks like this or brings it up in a way that is definitely using it as a, well, the liberal agenda has got another plant in Hollywood with... I really just want to kick people in the testicles hard with a boot.
All right. So, Supreme Leader Flame War has left, and Justin.
Oh, look, Justin's back. He's arrived.
We hate that other guy. Welcome back.
I knew what you meant, Justin. OP. Should have just used OP.
Yeah.
I knew what you meant.
Listen, I don't think she's OP, by the way. I mean, I think that
she's P.
If anything,
she's powered.
My biggest note with the movie is that I think that there is a lot of context that was either cut from the script stage or cut from the movie itself.
What I saw was comic books. They just all led off into a trail of comic books.
Well, yeah. J.J. Abrams and Lawrence Kasdan have both said repeatedly that Larry told me to trust the audience. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about explaining. And you can see that. Sometimes to your detriment, sometimes.
Sure. I think that almost every element of the film, it doesn't necessarily suffer, right? But it is, if all the questions, and I feel like where you are then led to think of things is because they did not want to have a scene that said, this is by taking out this solar system, we are leaving a power vacuum that the First Order can step into, or that, you know, we don't get more of Maz, Kanata, spelled with two N's and one T. that there is like, oh, okay, well, oh, you, I'll tell you, there's a legend of younglings that Luke was being brought up that had to be scattered throughout the universe. And I believe that might be you, Rey. And that's why you need to channel the force or feel the force and take the steps forward that might have given more context to why she tries to do stuff. I think that there are seeds for all of this when people are like, oh, wait, she just learns this force trick. Listen, she's very obviously up on the history of the legends, quote unquote, of what's happened. Who knows if part of that is literally the force trick for which she tries to use. Obviously, there are hints there in that direction. And as far as what we've seen. Well, why does Finn, why does Rey, how do they defeat the most powerful Sith in the history of the galaxy since Darth Vader? All right, how about this one, jerks? How many times does J.J. Abrams have to say that Chewie's bowcaster is not only more powerful than we've seen it before, but is this insane weapon that is blowing people to bits? That mm-hmm. even Solo is like, oh my god, this thing is super rad. We see that demonstrated 3 or 4 times in the movie before Chewie hits him right in the gut. We then see Kylo Ren hammering, apparently not hard enough to get the point through your head, message trigger, and into his chest, because he's trying to focus through the pain to fight these two people. He's bleeding on the snow as if it's a goddamn Kurosawa samurai movie before he then gets overtaken by somebody that uses not a gun, which again is explained. She's not a gun user. She's a bow staff wielder, which we see her do, making it not all that weird that she knows how to use a sword as opposed that she's picked up a sword and uses it effectively.
And she's very obviously lunging in those yeah. early parts of the battle as if she is using the pole, because that's what she's used to. There's also in the book Before the Awakening that just came out December 18th, there's a lovely scene of her discovering an old flight simulator and putting it in her AT-AT hovel and spending and describing how she spends all of her free time learning all the different ships in the database, because she discovered it in some wreckage, which explains how she's able to sit down the Millennium Falcon and know what to do at all. And yet when she first starts to fly it, flies it really badly and almost kills a bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
I would have loved to see 10 seconds of that. Just when they're given the little vignette of where she lives. Give me 10 seconds of her with the hood on.
Nope.
Doing
that's
the flight
episode one. Episode one. That's episode one thinking, my friend. Episode four just forges ahead with the main storyline. One story, one point, straight line, beginning to end. All of that is for deleted scenes. All of that is for VR, by the way. Are we not all going to be hanging out in Maz Kanata's amazing
oh, yeah.
place in like 2 years
that
or
that place
less?
Was insane. It was incredible.
Let's be clear. Yeah. We're all going to be there.
I'm sitting next to that robot. I'm sitting next to that weird junky robot that warned the rebels that something was happening. That guy was rad.
By the way, Alex, I'm actually kind of with you. Like, I understand why they didn't want to do it. I understand why every time that they wanted that it was written down in a script, they said, no, we can't. Just don't make the same mistakes. Whatever you do, don't make the same mistakes that the prequels did. I get it. However, I will be disappointed if we don't see more exposition in episode 8.
You will.
I can't have too many questions halfway through the movie that I need answered.
Yeah, no, that's it's a fair point. But I think you are going to get that stuff to some degree. But to just put a cap on that particular topic about her and her O penis or not, I should rephrase that.
I don't think she has one of those.
Hear anybody complain that John McClane beat all the terrorists in Die Hard. I don't remember anybody in
but no one else.
The million other movies with various people who are quote unquote overpowered given the circumstances of the film. No one ever brings that up. Why bring it up here? I do not understand. And I do understand. And they're all lying if they say that this is like some definitive thing that they can say for sure that this is a quote unquote Mary Sue moment or whatever the hell they want to call it. They're lying to me. Because it's bullshit. There's 1,000 movies you could make this you could talk about in this way, and you're not. Well, why? Because it's a bunch of dudes. All right, moving on.
But you know who's underpowered is Finn.
Yeah,
he's also a liar and a con man, and he runs away from things. And Maz Kanata said he's seen his eyes before.
What do you think that means? Seen his eyes before. What do you? We got
that's
a little.
Why I think he's force sensitive.
Do you think he's related to Samuel L. Jackson in some way? Is that
the deal? Well, number one, if you're going to guess of his famous parentage, you have two choices, right? So,
right.
Yeah.
No, actually, he could be Luke's. We don't know who the mother is.
That's true. It could be.
Luke was Jedi-ing all over the galaxy before he went into hiding.
Han Solo has very dark-skinned, quote-unquote, wife in the comics that are set between New Hope and Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. And look at you, Justin. We don't know what to make of you.
I mean, listen, all I'm saying is that when they open on Han's funeral and Lando walks by and just says, oh, geez, you look familiar. Like, well,
oh, no. I thought you were gone.
This deal gets worse all the time.
I gave the Empire my firstborn.
I want to discuss. So the big lead up to this, everybody was like, where's Luke? Where's Luke? Where's Luke? He's not on the folder. He's not on the folders.
No, I'm sorry. TVZ Gun just wrote, there was no mother.
But there was no Luke anywhere to be seen in any previews or anything, really, other than him on stage at the events and stuff. So when you finally do get his reveal, which happens literally in the final, minute?
Seconds.
Yeah, final minute of the film. Yeah. I was feeling like I was going to be terribly disappointed by that. And when I got there, it's like Abrams knew that we all needed a super hot, like, what's happening in episode 8 kind of ending. Because you've got him in the credits, you know he's going to be there, and boom, there he is, and now your movie's over. It got me more excited about the future of these movies than I expected. I expected to be disappointed and thinking, well, maybe they think Hamill's too hammy now. He does Joker too much. They don't want him on screen too often. But really, all they were doing is saying, yo, episode 7 is kind of a setup, everybody. There's way more stuff to get into. Like, where the hell's Phasma? I don't know. She kind of disappeared. Barely said anything. Interesting. I wonder if she'll be back. Well, of course she freaking will. Her and Hux and all those idiots, right? And the big CGI giant guy sitting in a chair.
He's 1 foot tall. Let's just agree on that,
right? No,
he's
actually 7 feet tall. It says so in the visual
description. Oh, it does?
Yeah. But you know what? They don't have any description of him anywhere. Mm. No one taught. None of the ancillary material mentions him. He doesn't have his own page in the visual dictionary. They are keeping his identity tightly under wraps. And I'm curious that Han, and I noticed this when I was taking notes for Pretend I'm Dumb, Han says one of his apprentices turned against him and destroyed the other students. He doesn't say it was his son. We all assume he means his son and he just doesn't want to say anything about it. What if it isn't? Mm. Because Snoke apparently tempted Kylo over. What if it was Snoke who was the person who turned against him? There's also the guy's 1,000 years old, like Maz Kanata too. So it would be weird for him to be Luke's apprentice, I guess. But
and he's maybe Darth Plagueis.
Yeah, there's that theory, right? That he's Darth Plagueis who brought himself back from the dead and then hid from Palpatine because he's weakened.
Mm. Well, what if he really was only a hologram?
Well, if we want
that's I thought about that.
If we want to get into extended universe, there's that whole that whole the storyline where spoiler alert, Thrawn dies and so they have a recreated version of Thrawn where people are it gets a little jokey at a certain point, but like that he is not like, you know, that Thrawn is thought to be dead, but however, oh, he comes back. But you can never see him, and he's only appearing via hologram. Mm-hmm.
Could be.
Yeah, I was thinking that kind of thing, too, sort of Wizard of the Oz, the Wizard of Oz style, where he may not even look like that. It's not just a giant head or something. It's not even him at all. He's just a normal, you know, human guy that is trying to run this empire type on the empire.
It's Darth Maul.
Yeah. Right, who knows? Yeah,
that'd be awesome.
It's Yoda's brother. No, I checked. Last time I looked, I was like, he's got 5 fingers. Damn.
Oh, yeah. And he's not split in half. So.
Yeah. I don't know what they do with him or any of that, but I'm so jazzed about it. Like, I cannot wait to see more about the things that were left mysterious and the characters who barely showed up. Like, we were all jazzed, like, oh, Phasma, it's a freaking what's-her-name from Game of Thrones. We're so excited about this. And then we get her for, like, 5 minutes, you know? And then,
knowing what I know now, I wouldn't have wanted more. It would have, like, her character fit. Well,
totally agree.
There are apparently, I had a big question of like, really, she would just like lower the shields for Finn, like because he had a gun in her head. It doesn't seem right. And apparently, we're going to get more explanation about why that happened.
Mm. Well, see, now this
can use the force.
I feel like this leads us directly into this particular territory, which is what do we expect from 8? So, anyone have any big ideas about what they think's going to happen? Go for it. Lay it on us.
Yes. Obviously, there is going to be Luke Skywalker is not staying on that island. Okay. Either Kylo Ren is going to come chase him off the island and he and Rey are going to flee together. or they are going to go take it to the Snoke or something. But this is definitely going to be an on-the-run movie, the way that Empire was an on-the-run movie. When nobody is sticking around places, they are going to be on the move and being hunted. Because, and again, this actually goes back to my one major criticism of Episode 7, thinking of it from a structural point of view, is just, I'm sorry, you guys just blew up like four planets I knew nothing about 2 seconds before, and you want me to care, and I don't know who they are, and I barely understand their relationship to the people I do care about. And so I think that there's got to be just like a hint more explanation of now what impact that has. It was very clear to me what the impact was when you blew up Vulcan, but less so this new Republic planet that's not Coruscant but looks like it, and I'm a little confused. So that's something I need addressed.
I'll tell you what, if we're talking about it echoing Episode 4, it's not like we got a ton of character or exposition on Alderaan before he blew it up like a firecracker.
Well, but Jimmy we did get Princess Leia saying, no, that's my home, that's where my family is, and you got an instant emotional connection. This one, it was like, there's a bunch of people on a balcony, and now they're gone. Yes. Okay,
yeah.
And I guess that means the Republic has been eliminated and the fleet is gone.
We got, I mean...
Fleet? What Republic?
Der Fuhrer Hux, you know, giving his big... good job, guys. We all worked really hard, so this is your Christmas party. Your bonuses are in your boots.
Yeah, I mean, it is referenced in the movie very quickly, and it's hard to catch that the Republic capital was in the Hosnian system that got blown up, and that the fleet cannot now help them because the fleet was there too.
Yeah.
Oh, man, they should get the fleet
off. I had to really go look it up and read it to understand, like, oh, okay, the capital moves around now. It doesn't stay in one place, and so it happened to be on the Hosnian system at that point.
Well, what do you think it is that's this? What is it about our mentality, though, that sees the depiction of what is clearly millions of people perishing versus one that we really care about on a thing? It's interesting, isn't it? I don't have really any commentary about that other than to say it's interesting.
That just gets into the whole, like, you know.
You care about what you know.
All tragedy relates to us. Like as Mel Brooks said it, tragedy is me having a hangnail. Comedy is you falling into an open manhole and dying. Like, you know, there's just all perspective is selfish.
Yeah.
Also, Spaceballs, The Search for More Money will be in production next year.
Oh, my gosh. That's for real deal then. That's happening.
Yeah, apparently.
All right.
Well, it's going to get made the same way Spaceballs got made because it's so popular. By the way, it's my favorite thing, is whenever Star Wars is around or about to get made, Lost in Space winds up getting rebooted. It happened in prequels, and it's happened now. Literally any space. Do you have a space property? Congratulations. There were golden ages in the late 90s and the late 70s, and now the mid 2010s. Your script is greenlit. Congratulations.
I'm down with it, to be honest. I mean, if someone wants to make more things like The Expanse, take my money.
Love that. Sure.
Yeah, I'm really, really into it. Alex, any thoughts on predictions about the future of the franchise, or at least this next movie? Not Rogue One. We'll skip that, but straight up Episode 8.
Well, yeah, Rogue One's kind of outside of the storyline, is from what I understand, or this particular storyline.
Sure.
Yeah, same world and everything.
Sure.
But I've been saying it for a while. I think we see Finn's character. Now, we saw some development of Finn's character, but we only saw now Finn. We have no idea, and he doesn't really even know what happened to him before. You know, he didn't even know his name. He didn't know his parents. He doesn't know any of this. So I think we either find out more about his actual past or simply about who he is. As in, like I've been saying, I think he is a Jedi, or at least Force sensitive. And my main ammo for that thought is the beginning. I don't know. It's not the first scene I've seen, but when he decides not to be a stormtrooper anymore, and Kylo Ren like just walking by just suddenly turns to him, and that's totally a Force nod nod to the Force rather.
No, I like Force nod. That's
Force
good.
Nod.
Yeah, I like that. And I didn't think of it that way. In my head, I was going, "Oh, Kylo Ren is sensitive to those who are going against him in real time." But I like your argument better. I like the idea that it was like, wait a minute, there's something about him.
Someone, and I don't remember who, and I really want to give them credit, made an excellent point that Finn may end up being Spartacus for the stormtroopers.
Oh, weird.
Oh, that's
I kind of like that idea.
Also,
I am Stormicus.
How is it that in a worse movie, you know for sure that we would be getting, you know, oh, great, another, finally, a black lead character in Star Wars. And he starts off as a literal slave with a slave name.
That's, I don't like to think about that. I'm going to pretend it never
happened. He frees himself.
He does.
I think that we're applying the fact that he's a black guy. There's lots of people in those suits who are all pulled as, I mean, that was one of the interesting twists of the story, and it was a great way for them to kind of rewrite the clone problems.
Because the clone
problems were like, all right, they're stormtroopers in the future. George Lucas will go back and digitally add new voices so they all sound like that New Zealand guy, and now they all have the same voice, and that's a terrible idea. Blah, blah, blah. Jump to this movie.
Did he do that? I didn't think he did that.
He did. The episode
four. The New Hope stormtroopers sound like Jango Fett?
Oh, yeah, big time. Just like that guy. Oh, yeah, it's annoying.
I did not notice that when I rewatched the remaster.
Yeah, the remasters.
No, and I watched the most recent versions.
Yeah, and it drives me crazy. I hate it.
Because I thought it was canon that the stormtroopers of A New Hope era were no longer all clones.
Well, unless...
Maybe some of them were.
Unless I'm crazy, I swear he went and changed all that stuff.
Okay. I didn't notice it. You may be absolutely right.
And it was always unfortunate. And I heard it and just went, okay, you don't have to force this in. So now I like what they did, though. Because these aren't all a bunch of clones that are just getting used forever. These New Order guys are, I mean, it's terrible because they're basically children being recruited and forcibly to be in, you know, the Stormtrooper army. But they're at least making all these differentiations. And I noticed in the movie, and I need to make sure in the second viewing, but I noticed lots of different people with individual voices as Stormtroopers when they spoke, except one of them sounded like the New Zealand guy, and he's in the credits. So I wonder if they've just... They're happy to acknowledge that was a thing, but now they're happy.
They didn't all die. I'm sure there's some that naturally reproduced and created.
Yeah, they told them they could have gotten clones. Didn't he say something to the effect of, oh, I should have gotten clones instead of, you know, whatever this army is?
They're just really expensive because the people on Kamino don't work cheap.
Yeah.
Well, and actually, they said that in episode two.
Wait a minute. No, I know why this is bothering me, because in Star Wars Rebels, there is an Imperial Academy that is training normal people to become stormtroopers.
Yeah.
Okay, so but are they
they can't all be clones by the time of A New Hope.
Well, that also leads me to think that they're not all slave kids either, right? I mean,
Scott, I'm only seeing that Boba Fett's voice was redubbed.
Oh, maybe that's it.
And that would make sense.
Am I mixing it? I could have sworn the stormtroopers all had the thing done. Maybe I've got that. But like when Obi-Wan's doing his thing when he's sneaking around, doing his stealth moves, and he's making it sound like moves. And those guys are going, oh, this is number, we're over here. What was that? I don't know. Like, they're just talking. I'm pretty sure that stuff got changed to be Australian guys' voice.
I can't find it, but
I'm gonna have to go look tonight. It's gonna drive me nuts. Because maybe you're right. And we'll do issue a correction.
Case, yeah, they weren't 100% clone anymore anyway, but I loved that nod to be like, yeah, maybe you should get clone troopers after all. And I also loved the line where Finn says, yeah, I'm with the Resistance. This is what we look like. I mean, some people look different, but it was a total nod to all of that as well.
Yeah.
It's very Harrison Ford reminiscent to me. Kind of that character.
He is, right? He's a little bit unwilling. He's a little bit scoundrelly. He's kind of got his own motives.
More Lando than Harrison.
By the way, one thing that I noticed the second time I watched it that you should look out for the next time you see it. Did you guys catch the symbolism of the jacket?
No. I've seen the jacket now.
Poe's jacket?
Are you talking about Poe's jacket? Yeah.
Poe's jacket, obviously, we first see him when he is very much being the hero.
Right.
Then he loses it in the crash, which, by the way, was supposed to be fatal. Initially told that was going to be it, and I thought I totally bit on that but when I was watching the movie for the first time. Then, of course, Finn wears it, and then at the very end, on the Stormkiller Bay or the Starkiller base, Rey wears it once walking into once they are like they meet back up. Rey wears the jacket. The jacket is always on the person that we are meant to think is the hero.
Oh, weird.
Then it's Finn, and finally, before we see her finally kind of embrace the force and fire up the lightsaber, Rey wears the jacket, and the jacket is always our marker
for who we believe to be the hero.
Ah, so there's a third Rey figurine now. There's Rey desert wear, Rey with jacket, and then Rey with gray sleeve that shows her
I
triceps.
I love that outfit. I was like, that is a cool, like, I'm about to be a Jedi outfit. I was down with that.
I agree. It was super cool and reminiscent of some of Luke's stuff. And yeah, mm-hmm. I liked all that stuff a lot.
He didn't like to show his triceps.
By the way, if everyone's theory is correct that that Finn is force sensitive, he's shit with a lightsaber. He's terrible with it.
Well, yeah. if Rey weren't as powerful as they explain, or obviously show her to be, she'd suck too. Plus, she had all this time, like Tom said, with the
staff.
Yeah, staff thing that she has. Yeah,
he was similar. Blaster trained.
Exactly. I also got the. Right. I could be wrong about this, but this is again that world building that lets your imagination be smart, so you don't have to be told everything. But I get the impression that part of her ability to tune in with the kind of meditation aspects of it, to kind of zone and get into a place where the force is flowing through you, you might be a little more prone to that if you're living way out in the middle of the desert, huddled under the shadow of the foot of an AT-AT by yourself for a huge amount of years. And, you know, you just get in touch with yourself, I guess.
Also, Kylo Ren is not very good with the force. He's not a Sith Lord.
Mm-mm.
He's strong. He can't.
If anybody's OP, it's him at the first scene where he stops a freaking blaster bolt and never does it again the rest of the film.
That was cool.
But he's clumsy with it. He's angry. He throws temper tantrums.
He's a
and
punk.
So when he pushes into Rey's mind, he does so without proper safeguards, is my guess, which provokes her abilities to leap up in defense involuntarily. And then she starts to realize what she can do.
Yeah. He kind of opened that bag of chicken, didn't he? Like, it's kind of his fault.
She actually does exactly what he does every time. And she gets better at it.
She learns through mimicry, right?
Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah, she basically is mimicking him, and she's like, oh, well, the Force can do that? Well, shoot, I can do that.
Yeah. You know? And he's slowly going from, like, this evil dude to the nervous guy that on the girls' show that's the boyfriend.
which he was shooting in between shots of Force Awakens, apparently. I saw an interview where he's like, I was flying back and forth to New York and then to London.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
All through.
I really, really liked his portrayal, and I did something interesting because I thought he looked a lot like Han Solo at a different mm-hmm. age. Went back, looked at some old pictures, just about a...
Have you seen the GQ cover?
No.
They have him in the vest from episode 4.
Oh, my gosh. You're kidding me.
It's crazy.
Wow. I have to check that out. Okay, Justin, let me throw you a hypothetical.
Yeah.
When they make their Han Solo movie, which is supposed to happen... Do they just cast him and pretend it's a young Han Solo, but it's that actor?
No. Apparently they want to go with even a little bit younger than him in some of the casting. Although they've actually got a pretty crazy age range. That almost like that made headlines, just the fact that like Phil Lord and Chris Miller are very, very keen on finding the right Han Solo and not necessarily pigeonholing it into like, well, he's got to be 16. And Tiger Beat ready, you know.
Zac Efron.
I think he should be like 8.
Han Solo. Ugh.
Just a real happy little kid.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Oh, and all.
I'm going to steal a Millennium Falcon. Woohoo!
I said at the top of the show I was going to try not to throw prequels under the bus, but I just have to make one tiny comment. The little girl who played young Rey when she was left on the planet had better acting in her one upset scene than the entirety of Jake Lloyd's portrayal of Anakin Skywalker.
Listen, I don't even want to trash Jake Lloyd because that script made great actors look like dogs. Mm-hmm. So, like,
yeah, it isn't him. Trust me, I'm not laying this at his feet.
Yeah,
but knowing,
I'll lay it at George's feet.
Yeah,
although,
yeah,
let's just all understand this: that we are now at the dawning of the golden age for our redemption of George Lucas. Right? Now that this movie is good. He let it go. Like,
that is his big move. Yeah.
This is now we can begin to appreciate like anything, right? If you part with somebody, either a job, a significant other.
Conscious uncoupling.
If there's a conscious uncoupling, you tend to remember the best. We tend to look at the sepia toned elements of our relationships. And now we can begin to understand George Lucas as a creative genius who gave us Star Wars.
But couldn't write.
And not the monster who gave us the prequel.
I go back to what I said earlier. If the maker of the Flash Gordon cereals had put out more Flash Gordon cereals when George Lucas was young, the way that he wanted the Flash Gordon cereals to look, Lucas would have hated them. And that's what happened with the prequels. Lucas is like, no, these are the kind of movies I want to make. This is the story I want to tell. Yeah. And we all wanted Flash Gordon, like, sensibility.
Hasn't he admitted as such?
Like JJ did.
And hasn't he actually said as much? He's basically said, look, I couldn't have the perspective anymore. I can't look at my own thing and see it the way everyone else sees it.
Yeah.
And also, I would just say that to make a larger metaphor is that sometimes people get so famous and so successful that they don't seek out teams anymore in the same way to cover, to help complement the things that they're not as good at. What is the first thing George Lucas did when he made Empire? He went and got a great director and he went and got a great writer. Okay. That was a guy who knew he couldn't do it all on his own. He knocked this $8 million movie that turned into a $10 million movie of Star Wars into something amazing, but he knew he needed help. And then by the time the prequels came along, he was basically like, I don't need the help. I want to tell the story my way. Now, look what happened here in The Force Awakens. You had Michael Arndt struggling with story, and so they brought in Lawrence Kasdan. J.J. Abrams buckled down with the script. They all got together for the good of the story and the good of all of us sitting out here suffering under the weight of those three child teenage destroying trilogies, prequels. And I think that that is the message to me, is that, you know, when you want to make something really good, you may not be able to make it alone, and that's okay. It's like sometimes it really does make a team to make something amazing. And that's what I love about this, is that there's a real sense of team. Everybody was in on it, and everybody's desire was to make a good, great Star Wars movie and shoot it off into the future. And they did it.
Anyone have any big final thoughts before we close up shop and pat this one on the back and tell it to go to sleep?
Very dope metaphor, Scott.
That was bad. It was going to get worse, too. I had to cut where I cut it.
But, burp it.
Burp it.
Hey, man, Star Wars is back.
Yay!
Yay!
Good movie.
And it's, you know, we had to talk about, I mean, because, like, listen, I'm sure that there were a million conversations among super nerds in 1977 saying, I don't know, man, I think that Han Solo has the Force. I think that that's what we're going to find.
Luke is OP?
Yeah. You know, so I think that it's so fun to have these conversations again. It's so fun to have a competent movie. And sure, it's not without its flaws, but I think it's super, it's rewatchable. It's a fun time, man. And that's really what I'm so excited about. And the idea that one of my favorite directors is going to direct Episode 8. Also, do you guys realize that we get Rogue One in December next year?
Yeah, a year.
Episode 8 is in May. It returns back to its ancestral home of May. That's crazy.
It's completely crazy. Yeah, like,
we don't have to wait the full 2 years.
Be shocked if it's moved back to December.
Yeah,
set pictures may be leaking as we speak from Episode 8.
Wow.
Yeah, didn't they just start doing something on it?
Okay. Yeah, they're shooting on the island, apparently.
Doing some of the shots.
Well, at least Mark Hamill has been seen going to the island, which I can't come up with any other plausible explanation for.
Well,
521 days, says Captain
that's
Kipper.
That's crazy. Are we going to, but when do we start having that conversation about, well, you know, Avengers 2 was okay, but it wasn't good. Like, when are we going to start? I don't want to get all down on this because right now it couldn't be any higher, but are we going to get fatigued pretty quick? Like,
let's start it now. Why not?
Wait, are we going to get Star Wars fatigue?
Yeah.
Have we got Marvel fatigue?
A little, tiny bit. I mean, no,
the movies aren't great. Like, yeah, people criticize the movies aren't great. Doesn't mean that we're like, stop these Marvel movies.
Yeah. No,
yeah, I don't think the one-offs will be a detriment to the series at all. It's exploring different pieces of that same universe. You know, like I said, they do such a good job of creating this lived in, feels like it's been here a million years and this took place a million years ago type of universe, that I want to see more of it, and I'd be happy to. And as long as you keep those one-offs away from the main storyline, then you're fine.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't mind seeing, like, Lorsan Tekka explained a little bit in Rogue One, right? Something like that that ties me in, but otherwise staying off the main story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Little bits and pieces, yeah.
Stories in this universe where everyone doesn't have to be a Skywalker.
Yeah. Well, that's what anthology should deliver. Yeah.
Like, just because that's all we've ever, I mean, like, there's been an element, and it's very much one of mine, that it's like, okay, like, if Rey is Luke's daughter, that's fine. If Rey is, you know, a mind wipe twin with Ben, then that's all right. You know, like, fine. I would like for other characters to not be Skywalkers. So I'm very excited about, you know, these other one-offs that are like, great, cool. I would like to have non-Skywalkers in the Star Wars universe.
I think they, seems like they've got that planned. I mean, at the very least, the Han Solo thing is not a, if he's the focus, there's not going to be some force-wielding focus. And if he's, and if the Boba Fett one is all about Boba Fett, well, he's got no force, you know. He's in a, you know. I hope his story is all about his 1,000 years.
That?
Well, he needs to be sitting at a small table playing solitaire in the bottom of the Sarlacc pit for 1,000 years. That's my movie idea. That's what he needs to do. It doesn't need to be a prequel. It needs to be just after the events of Episode 6.
So we, it's he'll actually come out with my a different dinner accent? With Andre. It's just yeah. Boba Fett alone for 2 hours.
I love it. I love it.
I guess my only major concern about Episode 8, really, when it comes down to it, is will there be Batman? Where is Batman, and why has he not been in this movie?
Well, if Marvel, if Disney owned DC as well, I would say all bets would be off. Right now, right now, Batman's trying to decide if that next movie is going to be any good at all.
Hey, by the way, they showed the Captain America Civil War trailer right before the Batman Superman trailer in my theater. Hey, boy.
What happened? What was this? What was the breakdown?
The crowd cheered for one of them. I'll let you guess which one.
Damn it. I don't want them to blow this. I want it to be good. Can I still hope that it's good? It's okay to hope, right?
Hope all
Batman
you want.
Superman?
Yeah.
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 I'm sorry, Scott.
It's hope wrong.
Spring, Scott.
All right.
I could do nothing for you.
I'm going to hold some hope. A little hope, okay? Just
tu
a little
esperanza
bit.
Tu esperanza es admirable, mi amigo.
Thank you very much. All right. Well, I think that'll do it for us. Let's quickly go around the table and give people a chance to tell the fine folks listening at home where else they can be found on the internet. Jury, let's start with you. Where can Jury be found?
You know, mostly on Twitter, just mucking about at Justin R. Young. And you can, of course, listen to me on the morning stream
tomorrow.
Tuesdays.
Yeah.
And, you know.
He talks me down from ledges when he comes on. It's great.
Maybe fun Frog Pants projects.
Something brewing on the back burner there. Yeah, watch for that. Justin R. Young on Twitter, of course. Jenny, what's going on? Where are you?
Well, we just put out the first of 4 Tell It Anyway holiday episodes. The first one was really fun. The second one's about Hanukkah. The third one's a crossover with our girls from Hooray for Garbage Town. But the fourth one is the one I'm really excited about. It's a really amazing story about Matt Flanagan and some stuff we've never talked about before, about where he almost spent one Christmas. And we're sort of nervous about it and scared about it and really excited about it. And it means a lot to us to finally be able to, it's like why we started a podcast called Tell It Anyway. So check it out at tellitanyway.com. It's going to be real.
I'm intrigued. I'm going to check that out. Fantastic. Alex, tell us where the fine folks can find you, sir.
I also have a Twitter account. It's at Tinvec, 2 N's and a C. The rest of it, I think you can work out. There's also tinvec.com, same thing on Twitter or on Twitch. And I don't know, just about anywhere else. I'm there.
You're out and around and about. People should be checking him out as well. Tom, any final thoughts, sir?
Man, this was a blast. I want to thank you guys for hanging out for a supersized Current Geek, finishing off the year strong. I did a labor of love, if you haven't heard me go on and on about it already, called Pretend I'm Dumb About Star Wars. And I finished episode 7 of that short run podcast on Sunday. We'll see if I do Rogue One. I definitely plan to do episode 8 when it comes out. But this is fun. And if you didn't hear me talk about it, I approached this series as if I had never seen any of it before. So I started with episode 1 and I talk about the movies from the perspective of someone who's never seen them and has no preconceptions about what the prequels should or shouldn't be or how the middle three fit in. And I had a blast doing it. So if you want to check that out, go to TomMerritt.com, look for PIDASW, Pretend I Know About Star Wars, or YouTube.com/AceDetect.
Or YouTube. I like that.
YouTube. That's the Utah's version of YouTube. We have a separate one.
The Moab YouTube.
Yeah, we're still working on it. We'll let you know when it's in alpha. YouTube. Well, big thanks to everybody to echo Tom's thoughts. What a great year for Current Geek. Thank you all for a wonderful 2015 and a great way to end it with lots of talk about one of our favorite things of the year. We're so glad to have brought it to you. If you have any thoughts or comments, as always, email us currentgeek@gmail.com. If you want to find us on Twitter, Current Geek is the show. Tom's at Ace Detect. I'm at Scott Johnson. And as always, you can leave us voicemails, 801-471-0462. currentgeek.com for everything else. I think that's going to do it for me, for Tom, and for our fantastic panel. We'll see you next time. Where's your thing, Tom? Thank you. There you go.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we look at how one of the hottest holiday gifts in the U.S. may soon be subject to much more regulation than currently, that gift being drones and other model aircraft. Drones, also called unmanned aerial vehicles, have become more common as evidenced by some popular commercials making fun of this trend. Approximately 1 million UAVs will be sold this holiday season, including a lot of drones to go with your typical motorized model aircraft and helicopters. That hot trend has raised some eyebrows at the Federal Aviation Administration, so much so that more regulation appears to be on the horizon. After all, there's no constitutional right to fly such devices. Still, the process has already begun, with a detailed proposal delivered from the Rulemaking Committee of the FAA at the end of last month. The big debate leading up to this proposal was whether the threshold for requiring formal registration of UAVs would be based on weight or performance of the aircraft. Weight ended up being the choice, specifically any aircraft weighing more than 250 grams, or about half a pound, being subject to registration. This will force all but the smallest toys to have the owner registered with the FAA. Interestingly, only the owner will be registered, not necessarily the operator, so the information actually collected will be limited. The FAA currently does registration business in paper with carbon copies. So before this regulation goes into effect, expect some significant upgrades with electronic or software app type registration becoming available. The free inhabitants from our last full segment certainly won't like another government registration requirement, but the FAA set that low weight limit based on what would jeopardize safety in a crash from 500 feet or higher in the air. So while it may feel like government intrusion on people's privacy and not really collecting enough information to stop terrorism risks, this is the first step in protecting safety of everyone. And that's probably the right time for government to function in this manner. The bottom line is, when an industry or hobby gets this big, it's difficult to escape governmental regulation. Until next time, enjoy your drones and model aircraft hanging in your stockings and under your trees. At least your BB-8 toy won't need registered yet. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy. And check out my other podcast, Talking 10.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.